You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the network, its advertisers, owners, or sponsors.
This week's episode of Herd is brought to you by Pop Chips, and we are lucky enough to have the Detroit field marketing manager, Kelsey Hubble, in the house tonight.
How are you?
Great.
Thanks, Kelsey, for having me.
Kelsey, what's popping?
Pop chips are popping.
So what are pop chips?
Pop chips are potato chips, but instead of being deep fried, they are popped. So they get confused with popcorn, but they're actually made out of potatoes. They're gluten-free. They're less than 100 calories a bag. And we're all over town this summer just promoting the Enjoy More campaign. And you can find pop chips all over, Target, Kroger, and Meijer.
Awesome. Now, you brought five different varieties. All five varieties are available in the stores, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's start with the all-natural sea salt variety.
It's vegan.
They're very good. I mean, they taste like a potato chip. I mean, that's what they are, right?
Yeah.
So, talk through the flavors with me, please. So, we have the sea salt. We have barbecue.
So sea salt and barbecue, those are like the originals.
The barbecue has a nice smokiness to it, a little sweetness.
People really like the barbecue.
Mm-hmm. Then we have a zesty jalapeno cheddar.
That one's my favorite. It's got a little kick, but...
Oh, yeah.
It's good.
It's almost like a Dorito.
Yeah.
Can I say that? Is that
okay? It's like a healthy Dorito.
Yeah. Very good. It's got a good spiciness to it.
Now, and then we have the ridges, which are new. So those are the... cheddar sour cream and the buffalo ranch.
Okay, so these are in a black bag.
Yep.
So they're easily recognizable.
Yes.
Wow. This is going to be buffalo ranch is my jam. Yeah. That's a great flavor.
Big fan.
So you're going to be all around town. Are there some events coming up that people can find you?
Yep. We are at events all the time, sometimes just out running around after Tigers games, after concerts. You can see us. We're every Wednesday at Old Miami. Social Sports Detroit does a cornhole tournament, so we'll be there. And then, so you can find us.
And you're handing out samples?
Just giving away free snacks.
Free snacks and other swag sometimes?
Yep. So we've got all kinds of swag. Water bottles, beach towels, perfect for a barbecue party.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So once again, pop chips, pop, not fried, potatoes, gluten-free, all those really great things. They're a great alternative to your regular old potato chip.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Kelsey.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, pop chips.
Thanks.
Coming to you from Podcast Detroit, it's Herd, your food, beverage, and hospitality podcast. Herd is a collaboration between the Hungry Dudes, Nick Drinks, and the Detroit Optimist Society. Each week, we interview industry professionals about issues related to food, beverage, and hospitality. Please take a moment to subscribe to Herd through the Apple Podcast app, Google Play, SoundCloud, or however you subscribe to your podcasts. Write a review and let us know what you think. For additional content, including awesome videos and photos, visit herdpodcast.com. Like Herd Podcast on Facebook and follow at Herd Podcast on Instagram. We appreciate your support and hope you enjoy this week's episode of Herd. Hello, friends, and welcome to Herd, your food, beverage, and hospitality podcast. I'm Joe Hakeem. Tonight, we are recording from the Detroit Shipping Company, the brand new Podcast Detroit studio on Peterborough Street. In this shipping container complex, where there is a bar and restaurants downstairs, Nick went to one of the restaurants, Brujo.
Yeah, can I just say I'm really uncomfortable? All these people are staring at me through the windows. I feel like I'm a fish.
I know. It's
right there. She just looked at me again. She keeps looking at me over there.
She's checking you out.
You got something on your shirt.
Podcasting is some crazy stuff, huh? So obviously Nick is here.
Hello.
Jason's
Maybe
here.
Maybe they think you're a food critic.
Yeah, right.
Vato is here.
Hey-o.
And our special guest is the chef partner of Wright & Company, Peter Burrow, Bad Luck, Mark Joslia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Mark, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm excited to have you.
I'm happy because it's National Tequila Day and you gave me some.
It is National Tequila Day, which is exciting. I mean, honestly, any day can be National Tequila Day if you try, right? Mm. But Jason was gracious enough to bring a couple bottles with him. Can we kind of talk about what you brought with yourself?
Sure. It's a couple bottles. One's just a classic silver tequila, 100% agave. These are both El Mayor brand, which I think is a good for the price point. Some of the better tequila that you can find. Also, shout out to Tara Jagodzinski. She was just in Tales of the Cocktail last week. Tara is a bartender at the Peterborough. She won the regional competition for Exotico Tequila, which is owns the El Mayor brand.
Which I was a judge for that competition.
Ooh, yeah. So Nick was a judge. So thanks for passing her along. So she was representing Detroit. Against six others in New Orleans for Tales of the Cocktail, and she did bring home the national honors. Okay. So congratulations to that. She'll be traveling to visit the distilleries down in Mexico as part of her
Mexico.
Winnings. Yeah, Mexico. So we've got the Blanco, and then we've got the Añejo version. So just a little bit of age on that.
So what is when an Añejo bought that's aged in oak or like is
yeah
it, yeah, and then if there's a few beers that have come out recently that are Asian tequila barrels, yeah? The
not coming to mind if they are.
There's one by Avery. It's a lime. It's a Goza. It's Asian tequila barrels, as far as I know.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's a good story.
I'll be passing that up in the aisle.
Wait, really cool question. So, obviously, you know, the Detroit Optimist Society have a great selection of tequilas. Where is the premier spot to go get tequilas and agave liquors in Detroit? Has anyone claimed that stake?
That, you know, that's really interesting. I don't remember what the date we have. We're having Keiko's on in the future. But I was just talking to him the other day because we've been having this ongoing discussion about tequila. He keeps telling me every time I visit him that, you know, tequila's booming. You know, he's selling a lot of tequila, a lot of upper end tequilas, and I'm just like, I don't see it because people don't really come into our right spots and order tequila. It's not one of the top calls, and so
yeah. The Cabresto boys have announced this week or last week that they're opening a tequila bar.
Sure, but yeah, they're, I don't know what that looks like. They already have their own brand, so I don't know what that means. He said that is there a Royal Oak at Rojo? Is that a place? Rojo.
Birmingham has Birmingham? A Rojo.
Yeah, maybe Birmingham has Rojo. Yeah.
He said that was the premier place of all the spots for like 100 plus tequilas. I don't know. I've never been.
Their selection's pretty solid. I'll give it that.
I can't even think of a place. Maybe I'm not well traveled enough. Maybe Mark knows something that I don't know. But no, I can't think of a place that's really like.
I just read that there was some gentlemen. One of them that used to be involved in Eddie Bar's. Eddie Vargas used to be involved in Eddie
Bar's. Yeah, that's the Cabresto one.
Yeah, they're going to be in the old Casey's or Red Quarter, shall we say. But that they're renovating it now.
In Corktown.
Yeah, so that's supposed to be a tequila bar, so maybe that will be the representation. You know,
I mean, Bakersfield was kind of like, we're tequila and tacos, but I wouldn't say that their selection is, by any standards, like excessive or extensive.
I have yet to get there. Yeah. So.
Is that because...
It's on the same block as Empire.
Is tequila not, like, has not reached a pinnacle of, like, being a sipping spirit?
I think it has.
Around here, I mean.
This is like, awesome.
I mean, oh, yeah. And I'm not denying the flavor of it, but I'm saying like you have bourbon and...
Bourbon just takes so much of the oxygen in the room that I feel like that just crushes any scotch bars or tequila or... I mean, I don't even think we have a rum bar, really. I mean, we have tiki places, but I wouldn't say any of them have like a bazillion rums.
Yeah, I feel like if you're in the Southwest, you probably find a lot more tequila bars. Indianapolis, actually, strangely enough, had a really good one.
I was just there. What's the place?
I can't think of the name. I had to Google it.
I was literally just there this weekend.
I think it's in Fountain Park.
Okay.
That's the neighborhood, but I don't know.
Okay, so I would like to go back to last week and revisit the Empire article. But I want to revisit it in a different light. So Chicago Tribune's food critic Phil Vitale, after 30 years, has kind of unmasked, as the case may be, to use a wrestling reference, a pro wrestling reference.
Or a superhero reference.
Or a superhero reference.
A burglar or any people that can wear a mask.
Okay, fine, whatever. I know pro wrestling guys. You know that. Right.
Thanks, Mean Gene.
So after 30 years, he kind of wrote an article and said, here I am.
What did he do the first 30 years?
He was hit.
He was writing the whole time.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he was hidden behind the veil of secrecy. But since social media kind of took off in the last few years, he said it's been a pretty poorly kept secret. Hmm. So I think this brings up a point of to kind of bring up the Empire article again is these people are like Mark Kurlianchek is not a well hidden.
No. You know Mark's coming in.
Yeah.
Like you see Mark walking in and you're like, oh, Mark's eating my food, my trash can pizza.
Trash can pizza. True. And so does that like make the experience of not knowing who your local food critics is that on the restaurant? Should you know who your food critics are and should they be treated differently?
Well, does everyone coming into a restaurant get the same experience? Let's start there.
No, of course not. They're the person that you know that's coming in who is either going to be reviewing you or who is going to be featuring you in something, or whether you're a critic or not. If you're just coming in taking photographs and you're not a critic and you're not, you know, you don't have any culinary background, they are going to do their best to prepare the best dish. Mm-hmm. They should, you know, because it's going to be presented to the masses, do the best to present the best dish that they can and give you the best experience. So that way you can go back and tell whoever your viewers are, readers are, et cetera, that, you know, this is what the norm is at this place. And that's the clandestine reviewer. The benefit of that kind of way that operated is that you were able to go in as the average Joe, Hakeem, the average Joe, and not have any preferential treatment, so that you could say that this is the way an average person gets. It's not an anomaly, right? You can extrapolate this one, two, three. I mean, and it shouldn't be one. It should have been multiple visits over the course of, you know, not right when they opened, right? I mean, there's some standards that a clandestine reviewer should have had and say, all right, I'm going to go there, you know, a couple times over 3 months, and then I'll extrapolate that and say that this experience would be like this.
But back to the original question, like you said, they're not unknown. Everybody knew who Sylvia Rector was. Everybody knows who Molly Abraham is. Everybody knows who Christopher Cook is. You know what I mean? So
right.
It is just based on your own responsibility and taking your own chances to not do the research to make sure that, you know, the staff knows and keep an eye out for them. And, right, you don't have to bend over backwards for them because, right, you don't want to act like you went over the top and they might not write anything about you. You know what I mean? So that's but you also – I used to work for Wolfgang Puck for a long time. One of the partners, Lee Hefter, used to tell me, he goes, you know when I'm coming. You know what's going on. If the restaurant's messy, you're not doing that. It's like I throw you a fastball and I tell you it's coming down the middle and you don't hit it. That's on you.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know what I mean? So that's – it's on them a little bit. Yeah, so –
I dig it.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned She-Wolf last week and the great experience I had there, but what I didn't mention and probably should have is that I had two extra pasta courses brought out to me, unordered, you know, on them. It didn't change my feeling of the restaurant.
I didn't get anything great free.
Well, you're
I've been there twice.
You're an influencer, you know, and that's the new critic, I guess, right? In a way, is the influencer.
Well, I'm not a critic.
Yeah, but it's not about being a critic, but my question would be just to specifically about, you know, being unmasked after 30 years, but the idea that, you know, the newspapers, for whatever decline they've seen in relevance relative to other mediums, particularly in digital marketing, everybody is a critic. And not necessarily that they're saying things on their posts, but, you know, they might not post or they may post, but there are people there all the time that are, I think, building a continual, like, living opinion of your place,
crowdsourcing it
in a way. Yeah, you know, it's a little bit like that in my opinion. So I think there's a larger question, and how will that continue to evolve over time as more and more people, I mean, I was just next door at the Peterborough for a minute, and one of the brands, there's an Indian liqueur, Samrus, I believe is how you pronounce it. I could be mistaken, but
they're doing an event.
They're doing Thursday. An event, yeah. And they've got it. No, it's today. It's right now at the Peterborough.
Am I supposed to be there?
Are you an influencer? Yeah. So, I mean, the point is they're bringing in these people to actively, you know, I guess promote in a way. you know, that experience and that brand.
And there's no getting away from reviews and ratings. If you Google anything, the first thing you see under the name of the restaurant is your Google rating.
Yeah.
And that's not, I mean, that's crowdsourced by anybody who takes the time to leave a Google review, right? And then Yelp is usually the first one or the first or second link that a restaurant has to contend with outside of its own homepage, if it's even got this the SEO to get its homepage up to.
If it has a webpage.
If it has a
webpage. I feel like now there's some restaurants that are just leaning on Facebook or Yelp.
Or Instagram.
Or Instagram, yeah.
So with the Optimist Society, you guys all have separate web pages for your properties?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And like
Jason hand-coded everyone, each individual character.
Okay, so let's...
But yes, they're all different websites, and there's a certain point where you can quantify some of that stuff and say, like, you have a Google My Business listing, you know, and they give you insights about the amount of traffic on your, not just your webpage, but on your Google My Business listing. So now when people search for a company or a restaurant or a bar, you know, the first thing that most people are seeing before they even get to the website is the Google My Business listing, which has the information, the hours, the review score, the menu link. You know, it's got a bunch of things that, you know, most people probably will find what they're looking for right there before they even get to your website. And so, but you can take that and aggregate out and say how many people are looking at that information versus reading the critic's article. I mean, obviously this particular article was seen by more people because the nature of the controversy caused it to be talked about and shared. And we're talking about it right now, but how many reviews that have happened on the Free Press or Silver Rector, they're just like, good review that, you know, it lives for a minute, and then 6 months later, people are still going to be there reviewing your space, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas the critic only exists in that time frame.
Yeah, and I mean, the Empire article's kind of had its moment, right? It hasn't been mentioned. I haven't seen it mentioned at all this week. And that's the nature of, you know, the 24-hour news cycle and everything that comes up and the kind of daily exhaustion that happens trying to keep up with everything that's happening in the world. And
I think when you're thinking about the actual customer journey of discovery of a business, you know, if they become aware of your business through word of mouth or digital marketing or any, you know, just like Kelsey was here, they become aware of your business because they're downtown passing out, you know, snacks. The bottom line is, you know, people are going to go to Google. They're going to Google it to get the hours or the information or a better look at what that brand is. What's not going to come up is most likely the review from that place that happened. You know, they're going to get whatever the most timely information is that you put up there. And so,
this is anecdotal on my part, but I bet it attracted as many people as it pushed away.
I went there the day after that came out because I was curious.
Yeah.
What kind of?
Although I'm not going to Long John Silver ever. So,
did Mark Kulianchek review that last week?
Now, we brought that in 2 weeks ago. But I mean, it was so one thing that he brought up is, so obviously me kind of focusing on cocktails, he brought up that there were craft cocktails and he brought up the price point, but he didn't say anything about them. So that kind of piqued my interest, what's happening with cocktails. And Chuck was making some delicious cocktails and it was just about to drop a new menu. So, you know, he's in there to review the food, I guess. But I mean, there's still a story to tell kind of with the cocktails. All stuff I brought up last week.
I mean, any restaurant's a living, breathing thing.
Right.
So there's stories to tell with the food, story to tell with the drinks, or stories to tell with the people working there, all these things.
The vibe, the atmosphere, the decor, everything's got a story.
The service, all of that. And it's hard to, you know, it's hard to, you know, bring that all into one review, right? And so there's part, you know, that, like we said last week, there's part of me that, you know, it's a viral type of thing, and that's what it ended up being. People shared it because it was negative, and
it was provoking. So I think that's why people shared it too.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but it was because it was negative. I mean, how many people shared the response? Not many people shared the response.
But his mom did.
Wow.
All right.
All right, Mark.
Classic.
So brisky.
Okay, so Mark, you mentioned Wolfgang Puck. He used to work for Wolfgang.
Yes, yes,
so how did you get your start as a chef and then kind of segue into how you started working for Wolfgang?
Well, I grew up in Madison Heights, and when I was in high school, there was a vocational schools in Oakland County, and it was an acronym. So mine was Southeast Oakland Vocational Education Center, which was known as CEAVEC. And I had a couple of buddies that were going there. One of them went for heating and cooling. One of them had a car, an old Challenger, and he got to work on it in his auto mechanic class. And they were saying, you know, it's a lot more fun than going to music or your electives in your junior, senior year of college or high school. So I looked into the curriculum, and I thought I was going to go take the culinary arts for two things. One, I thought I'd be able to eat all day. And then two, maybe I thought I'd meet some chicks. You know what I mean? So I figured this is the best avenue. And then as I did it for a while, the only thing I really have a knack with was math. And so devising the recipes, costing things out and things like that came really natural to me. And I started getting good at it. So I started helping some of the other kids. And my teacher said, maybe this is something you should pursue. Now, I was 18 years old and I wasn't the best high school student known. And my parents thought I was a little crazy because, you know, in the late 80s, you know, being a chef wasn't sexy like it is today. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? So it was just a workman's job, a trade, just like anything else. And they would have preferred at that time I did something a little more cerebral, shall we say. My dad was an engineer and things like that. My sister was an engineer. And so that was kind of the goal. But like I said, I was really good with my hands. You know, I like to be more interactive. I'm a little anxious. So it just kind of fit. And so I thought I'd give it a try. And we're very fortunate the way it worked out. So after I left the cooking school in New York, I came back here briefly. And my parents retired to Las Vegas. And I went to Maui, Hawaii for a while. And I fooled around the beach for about a year and a half. And then I started to get a little more serious. So I moved to Las Vegas. And I met Wolfgang Puck there when he opened his first restaurant in 1993. And so I was part of the opening team there. And and you know, when I was working for the Hilton briefly, and I really didn't like it very much. But I saw on TV that there was Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which is kind of funny because it turns out Robin Leach was a really good friend of Wolfgang's, and you know, so it was that like some inside pub, you know. But he said it was the best restaurant in the United States, and I was sitting on my couch, and then I read 2 months from now he's going to open one in Las Vegas. So I'm like, well, maybe if I get in a place like that, I can make something out of this career rather than fooling around, you know, working banquets at the Hilton and things like that. You know what I mean? So that's how it all started, and then I worked for the man almost 18 years, opened 9 restaurants for him all across the country, and I ended up back in Detroit to open the restaurant at the MGM Grand originally.
And that was back in?
The restaurant at MGM was 2007.
Okay.
I moved to Atlantic City, and I was really done with living in Las Vegas, so I told him I'll take the next job out of town. I don't care where it is, and he said, be careful what you wish for. We're going to send you to Atlantic City. So I went to Atlantic City, and then you know, I was only there for a little while. And he goes, you know, Mark, we send you back to your hometown. You go back to Detroit. And I said, Detroit? You mean like Detroit, Michigan? Like, have you been there? You know, it's 2005. Like, you know, like, what are you talking about? And so after some, you know, jockeying for positions, some turn downs, and then some sweetening of the pot, shall we say, I told him at one point, I'll go, but it's going to cost you. You know what I mean? And I also wanted out, so I didn't think I'd be here for a long time. But when my out came, per se, after 2 years, the economy was bad, 2009. So I didn't really have anywhere to go, you know. So I stayed because I wanted to have a job, of course. And then, you know, as time went on, the town started to change around me. I really liked it here because there was a really good sense of community. You know what I mean? The people that live downtown Detroit, you know, I used to joke around that, you know, 50 people live downtown because everywhere I saw the same 50 people. You know? but they were all really cool 50 people that were really conscientious, and, you know, and Slo's was a community hub. And, you know, I met lots of great people like Andy Holiday and Dave Mancini and Phil Cooley that, you know, because that's where we all hang out, you know. And then people had ideas, and they said, if only had some money, or if only had a building, or if only had an opportunity, you know, think of the great things we could do in a town that we thought was going to emerge sooner or later, you know. So. And so that's how I stayed, you know. I'd always hoped to springboard off my current existence into a place where I could do something on my own. I never thought it was going to be Detroit. But like I said, the town grew up around me, and I lived right on Woodward. And, you know, I used to walk around and say, where do I get to go eat downtown Detroit, eat and drink?
Yeah.
And then when the Young Professionals came with Quicken Loans and such, I said, where do they get to go eat and drink? And that's when the light bulb went off, and I said, you know, me and my business partner, Dave, we were already working on a project that kind of fell through. But I said, I think downtown is where it should be, right in the middle of the commerce of where it's all going to come back. It's going to come back right here in the middle and work its way out. So that's how we started Writing Company. I quit my job about 5 years ago, and we've been open 4 years this week. So we're coming up. So,
yeah. So talk about Writing Company and like the concept and like from the beginning.
Yeah, so I knew Richard Chayette, who was Dan Gilbert's legal counsel. He used to come into the Wolfgang Puck restaurant, and he used to come in late. And he would, you know, he'd go, oh, sit down and have a drink. Let's talk about Detroit, you know, because Dan's bringing all these people down here. What do you think they should have, and what should they do? And so he was already, like, trying to ask me questions about where the town was, where he thought it should head. And so when I decided that I was going to try and do something on my own, I contacted him. I said, why don't you put me in charge with whoever can show me around some of the buildings and look at some different opportunities? So they took me and Dave around town, and the last place we stopped at was Wright & Company. There was another place that we were interested in, and they go, well, this one isn't really available through some miscommunication. And they took us to go, there's one that we haven't shown anybody yet, and they took us upstairs, and it was really light-colored wood, and the sunshine was beaming through, and you know, it looked like an old European coffee shop or something like that. And Dave looked at me and said, this is the place, you know? So we kind of fell in love with it before we knew what we were going to do with it. You know what I mean? We're kind of in that little mode, like we were just so gung-ho enough to have a cool spot. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then once we started doing some of the architectural and trying to figure out the dining room and things like that, we realized the kitchen was going to be a little small. So we didn't really have the ability to, say, have 12 plates go all at the same time or something like that. There was nowhere to stage them, nowhere to put all of them on the plates so everybody could eat at the same time. So we said the only way we're going to be able to do this in a space is to come up with some kind of shared plate concept. And also, you know, we called it a gathering place when we first opened because we had nothing to compare it to. You know, my good friend Andy Halliday was opening a restaurant, but because they bought the building, it took them a lot longer to get going, and they opened probably 3 or 4 months after us.
That's Selden Standard.
Selden Standard, yeah. Yes.
Yep.
So we didn't have anything to compare it to. So we were like, well, if we build the bar long, and if you come and have a beer before a baseball game or a glass of wine after the opera house that's all in the area or anything in between, that would be a success model as long as we generate revenue, you know, until the word got out, until the people kind of figured it out. So that's how it all came about, really. You know, we just threw all our money at it, and we thought we had a good idea, and we're very fortunate the way it worked out. And now the downtown area, it just gets better every day. You know, every time you turn around from the John Varvatos opening that's in the same building as us, that we did that, to the LCA, to all the hotels that are going up around us and all the commerce. The area, you know, as they always say in real estate, location, 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 although we had no idea at the time, here 4 years later, we're in a really, really great spot, and it keeps getting better every day. So.
And for location, I think it's really interesting. I can't think, I'm racking my brain sitting here trying to think, and I was trying to think before. I don't think there's any other like second floor restaurant in the city of Detroit.
Just the whiskey.
Well, but not a restaurant. Yeah. Like, right, this is like where, and I remember like, you know, the feeling the first time of having to go up in an elevator, you know, to get up to the rest. I mean, it just, you were transformed outside of.
It's very metropolitan, yeah.
Yeah, transformed outside of what Detroit was at the time. But it was just a small dial into what Detroit was becoming. And like you said, you know, Detroit kind of grew around that. But that was, like I said, it was very pioneering in that sense to find that location that lifted off on that second floor, you know, completely downtown. And I just thought that was neat. And I still can't, I mean, other than whiskey, like you said, the whiskey part, I can't think of any second floor restaurant.
If you go to a lot of metropolitan cities, I think of Washington, D.C. especially, there's lots of places that are, you know, a couple different floors and things like that. And there was a prominent businessman, which I'll leave him nameless for the time, came in and he was joking around about the space and things like that in a more of a fun manner. And he said, whenever you want a real storefront, you let me know. And I said, I don't know what that means. I said, because if we were on the first floor, all you would see is cars and people. Here, you see the dynamics of the city. You see the cityscape. You know, if you're at the table in the turret, you can look right down Woodward. You know what I mean? Like, it's a whole different dynamic to be able to see the architecture and things like that. So, like you said, that was very alluring to us as well, just to be different.
You know? Very high ceiling when you walk in. I mean, there's just a lot to that. You know, we talked about how, you know, it's, you know, you got the whole experience. I mean, we're talking about the critic, you have the whole experience kind of thing. The whole experience starts the minute you push that button and when you get into the door and you're like, okay, I got to take the elevator and it's going to go to one spot. Right there, the experience starts and it transforms. I think it transforms you into a whole different thing. And that's, I'll never forget the first time I went in there. It was just, you know, unique. And living in Detroit my whole life, never experienced anything like it. In Detroit, you'd have to go somewhere else outside the city for that.
Yeah, it's interesting because sometimes, you know, we have windows in the kitchen, which is unique too, just the way the building is set up. And every once in a while, you see someone on their phone going on and looking around like, I know it's around here somewhere.
But that's
part of the fun too. You know what I mean? Part of the allure of, you know, being a little bit off the beaten path and a little bit of an adventure, you know. And we really originally wanted the entrance to be in the alley, but the work on the Metropolitan Building that's lasted several years has hampered our ability, although there was a stairway back there. But that was the original goal, to make you walk in the alley and go up to the stairs that way. But I still don't think it detracts from still, like I said, the allure and the interesting journey to try and find it and get there. And then once you get in there, and you're like, wow, this is not what I expected. You know what I mean?
So, do you know how long that space was empty before you guys took it over?
I want to say it was about 8 years. There were a couple of nightclubs that did some different things. And I know Red Bull did a pop-up there for about a month. Because like I said, I lived across the street, so I saw the commerce, But no real viable business had been in there for about 25 years. Mm. So
is that where Pure was?
Yes,
it was.
Oh. Fervedo's on the ground floor.
And then it was, and then it was XS or something like that.
Oh, right.
And then there was it was Mineral Water or someone, or Red Bull or some conjunction had done some things there, some promotional things. And like I say, I lived across the street, so it's really ironic that I ended up inhabiting the building where I was like, that's a really cool building. You know what I mean? Like, it is a beautiful building. You know what I mean? So. Yeah.
What was it like shifting from the large kitchen in the MGM to this kind of smaller kitchen at Wright & Company?
Well, part of my goal is, I may be a couple years older than most of the chefs around town, was to, when I left Wolfgang, which was a really good paying job and a lot of respect and things of that nature, is that I wanted to create some freedom in my life. You know, I said, even if I made less money, I have to be a little more in control of, if I want to do something or go on vacation, or I shouldn't be straddled to an establishment that dictates it to me. I want to dictate it myself. So that was always the goal, and I'm fortunate that really worked out as well. You know what I mean? And making my fair share of money as well. But so that was really the goal, was to say that if I can build the infrastructure and I can get the right people in there, then I can kind of come in a little bit as I is. I don't have to work from 8 o'clock in the morning until midnight every day, find some people I could trust. And it's like I said, it's been awesome. Now, just like every restaurant, you have staffing issues occasionally where I have to work just as hard as I ever did. Like last month we had a transition of some of our management staff, things like that. But when it's going, we have the proper people in place. I go in there in the morning, I make sure they're on the good pace. I leave in the afternoon, I go do a little something, I go back for service. I stay only as long as it's necessary. If they're fine, then I go. I don't feel the overwhelming need to be there all day long unless it isn't necessary, which was a real liberating feeling for me as well.
And that wasn't the case at the MGM where you had hours dictated to you. You had to be there all the time.
Yeah, there's I don't want to knock them, which is what it is, but there's some different hiring practices that hamper your ability when you lose somebody to get somebody in immediately. Like, you could be a month before you would go through the process where there's someone in another outlet that wants to come work for you, and then they have to find a replacement, and they shift them over. So I could go like 4 or 5 weeks without a cook. And also the way the union works, in a way, you don't get a replacement. Like, if someone goes on leave of absence for a couple of weeks, you don't have anybody else. You had 7 guys, now you got 6.
You don't get a temporary worker?
No, only if they can afford to do it sometimes. Mm. Not every outlet is just going to give you a guy, because everybody has the same problems per se. So there were, I foregoed a lot of vacations, And I love the guys, Wolfgang Puck, but, at one point, I was working for 2 people. I was working for the opinion of the MGM and the opinion for Wolfgang Puck, and I was in the middle, and I felt like I was in a no-win situation. And that's when I said, I shouldn't be doing this anymore, No matter, the hotel's unhappy, they're unhappy, I'm just the guy in the middle trying to explain what I'm doing my best. So that was part of the whole freedom part as well.
And you mentioned vacations a couple times. So now, since since Wright & Company was open and stuff, have you been able to vacation more?
We do lots of things. I joke around sometimes in interviews. I do a lot of the things that would never be able to do when I work for Wolfgang or the MGM Grand. Like I used to have to shave every day. I mean, literally every day. And they advised me if I didn't. The Cheval Hotel was like, did you shave today?
Because of all the public that goes in the kitchen.
You're not setting a very good sample for the staff, Mark. You know what I mean? Like, the cooks had to cover up their tattoos.
What?
Or things like that. Seriously. So I don't care if you have purple hair. I don't care anything. As long as you have hospitality, if you care about the restaurant, if you look out for our best interests, So I've shifted gears in my whole mentality about how we do business, building a culture.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we're closed on all major holidays.
Okay.
Like, we're closed for 4 days. We're closed on Sunday. We're closed on 4th of July. We decided to close 2 days before.
Uh-huh.
So there's also times that create themselves. We closed on Labor Day. you know, right after Labor Day, it's usually a little slower, right after the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shorter week for us. So the staff gets consolidated. So usually they're staffed properly if somebody doesn't want to come into work. And so those are the times that you could pick and choose, like right before the auto show, right after New Year's, usually slow. So there's times that we've created and some of little closures, a little couple extra days that make it easier for me to get out of town and go through things and things like that.
So should make it really easy in 2020 now that auto shows moving to summer.
I think I saw, obviously, you know, a lot of chefs and restaurateurs around town. Like, that's January is going to be a bad month.
It is. January, February, always.
January is going to suck.
Yeah, because really you had the ramp-up period, and then you had the black tie, and then even the auto show itself, at least people came downtown. You know, you had a reason to. So, yeah, so the shift to June is going to be tough. So we'll look at different ways. Like I said, maybe taking a little hiatus. I mean, if you read that Eater article about 4th of July, there were lots of places that closed for a week.
Right.
You know, nobody missed a beat. You know what I mean? Lady of the House, Mabel Gray. You know, I was like, we should close for a whole week. I mean, cause, you know, so you can build in your own vacation time, too.
Yeah, we
staff, for us.
But the thing with Lady of the House is they're off getting their 70th award in the middle of somewhere.
I'm not denying that. I'm not the media darling. I'm not cute enough.
But you guys have cooked the James Beard House. Like
we have.
And so how and was that?
I was nominated for a James Beard Award.
Which
once again, you know, I've told this story the other time. I had no idea. You know, I didn't open a restaurant that was my mind, and I've eaten in some of the best restaurants in the world that was James Beard worthy, and so. We had our Cafe 78 at the time at the MOCAD we were doing, and Andy Holiday and Natasha were going to come over and have lunch. It was Andy's birthday. So he's like, I want to come check out your place. I'm like, oh, come over. I'll make you some lunch. So I don't know. And so I'm in a meeting before that with a beer rep, and I get a text, and Natasha texts me, says, two of my favorite chefs have been nominated for a James Beard Award. Yeah. And I was like, I just looked at the phone. I'm like, who's she texting? You know what I mean? Like, and so I get there, and she gives me a big hug. She goes, can you believe that? I go, you're talking about me? I didn't even look. You know what I mean? She goes, you and Andy were both nominated for James Beard Award with, I think it was Stella and Garrett from Torino. You know what I mean? So first time. And it was 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was totally surprised, totally taken aback by it. So Sylvia Rector called me later that day, and she goes, you know, how does it feel? And I said, well, first of all, it's really surreal because I said, I didn't think about, you know, that wasn't what I was trying to accomplish. I was trying to earn a living and provide some jobs and create some freedom in my life. But I was also aware that there hadn't been a restaurant in 25 years that had the word Detroit next to it either. So I said, I think that's
what was the last one?
Jimmy the Rattlesnake Club in 1991. Hmm. So the other place, and she goes, well, what about Torino? I said, nobody knows outside of Michigan where Ferndale is.
Right.
Everybody knows where Detroit is.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So it's just different. To have me and Andy's names next to that, you know what I mean, and actually saying that Detroit's not this downtrodden crime-ridden city. There's some stuff going on here. There's some people trying really hard, and they're putting forth a lot of effort to try and make something happen. You know what I mean? And there's two places that somebody recognized that are it was really cool. So. Yeah, so it's still kind of surreal, and I said I haven't been nominated since, but I never expected to be anyway. So, so they invited us to James Beard House, which was really a great honor to come cook there, and it was just a great time. We closed the restaurant. I took my whole staff, all my managers, all my sous chefs, you know what I mean, so that everybody could experience this for themselves, you know what I mean, and hopefully they all aspire to that someday and open their own restaurants, do that, or maybe who knows what we do in the future. But yeah, for. But it was really, really cool to have that opportunity.
Has it impacted business at all?
Well, it sure don't hurt it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, we've been talk about every Tuesday we have a meeting with all our managers, and obviously Jason takes care of all of our social media session. We talk about the impact of marketing and things like that. We were very fortunate at the beginning that a lot of it was grassroots marketing. You know what I mean? Like, so we were lumped into different things. Like when John Varvatos decided to open the clothing store, they were like, it's in the same building as Wright & Company. You know, so every article was there. Or when Richard Branson decided to come and have a nonstop airline flight from London to Detroit every day. And then so the Daily Telegraph and the London Times were like, Detroit? Why? And so they all came. And then they, you know, there weren't that many restaurants open at that time. So they found Wright & Company. And they wrote about us in those. So you had all these things to hang your hat on. The New York Times wrote about us, you know, in the resurgence of Detroit. So all these things were happening every so often, and saying that this Detroit's turned the corner, and these are the people that are helping it, and this is where you should go eat. And so there was a lot of that going. Now, obviously, we're in a different state now. There's a lot more restaurants, a lot of great restaurants. And so now we have to try a little harder to hang on to our share, you know what I mean? Our piece of the pie, shall we say. But we, you know, I'm a firm believer that we worry about more introspectively than outside. You know, if we look inside our room and understand what we're doing right, wrong, or indifferent, instead of looking and caring about what they're doing next door, then we're always going to be fine. That's always been my philosophy. So,
and then you've added a couple places. I mean, you've added Peterborough, yeah. Added Bad Luck.
Yeah. So, you know, and those were all opportunities that obviously sprung from Wright & Company. You know, people saw what we were doing and really thought the restaurant was cool. And, the Bad Luck was a perfect example. Richard Broder from Broder Saxe, we knew Chase, who was his leasing agent for the Albert, and they had this dead space in this alley, and he was like, what should we do with it? Richard was talking to Chase, and he goes, I don't know, maybe we should try and open a bar back there. And he goes, who would open a bar in an alley? And he's like, I don't know, we go talk to Dave and Mark. You know what I mean? So they walked over there, we had a meeting with them, and then next thing you know, they gave us a really good deal to open this bar in an alley. You know what I mean? So we, you know, tried to just elevate the drinking experience at the time, you know. It's a little more quiet. It's obviously cozy and a little more grown up, I like to call it. You know what I mean?
Nick's not allowed there.
Yeah. No. I've been bad.
We did a Herd Podcast event there, though.
Yeah, we did an event there. Yeah,
we did an event there. But I feel like that poor security guard, whoever's that building in front, because I know when I first went to Bad Luck, I'm like, hey, how do you get there? He's like, it's in the back.
For the 100th time today.
you're cool if you know how to find it.
Yeah. Right.
I want to go back to something really quick, if you don't mind. When you're talking about the holidays and things like that, and you've been around the industry for, you know, like you said, from the 80s and whatnot, do you think that and I can't talk about the corporates, you know, the chains and stuff like that, but do you think the industry is going towards more of an HR kind of perspective as it relates to employees that say, hey, you know, we're not going to keep you in the kitchen for 16 hours. You're going to get some time off. We're going to get you, you know, some time with your family. And, you know, we know you're going to miss some of the, you know, same with cops, right? I miss so many Christmases, and there's so many people that miss, you know, every Halloween with their kids in Detroit because they had to work on Halloween night and blah, blah, blah. The same thing goes for chefs, right? Chefs miss every Mother's Day. They miss, you know, all these major kind of things. Do you see a change in that, in the industry?
Well, back to the original, where I said we want to change the culture, you know what I mean? Like, that's part of it. When I, you know, I left, when I was in my hiatus before Wright & Company opened, I left my job. It was the first New Year's Eve that I had off 21 years. So, you know, it's a conscious effort for two things. One, you know, there are some holidays where nobody's going to go out. Right. Nobody goes out on New Year's Day. So it's just a waste of time. You know what I mean? So that's part of it. And then like you said, it is important for employees to be able to spend time at Christmas Eve, New Year's Day, 4th of July. These are important holidays for most of America, you know. And so we decided to close them. The only one we're open on, and it's only for half a day, is Thanksgiving, because Cindy Paskey with Strategic Staffing Solution rents us out every year from 7 to 12. They have a float in the parade. She's a big sponsor of the parade, obviously, right on Woodward. And we're the warming station for all the volunteers. So we're actually helping as well as doing a party, you know what I mean? So we get paid for it as well. But, you know, we do a little half a day. So it's a little conjunctive effort with them. But that's the only holiday that anybody really walks in there for.
But if you look at time off, I mean, that is like kind of the American way. Like, you know, when we got to the point where we weren't working 7 days a week, a bazillion hours, you know, that was what Americans were striving for, was to have that time off to go leisure and spend money and consume and do all that good stuff. I feel like that's what should happen.
You know, and they said, there's lots of options. And we all know across the nation, not only Detroit, that the labor force is tough.
It's super tough, especially in the service
industry. So when I can say that you're never going to work on a Sunday at Wright & Company, you know
it's
mean?
Like,
or
sign
you,
me up.
Yeah, exactly. Or we'll do this or that, or competitive pay, you know, and you know, they said building the culture, you know. I tell everybody in the interviews, I say, you know, I can hire the best cooks money can buy, and a lot of them are a pain in the ass.
Okay.
I don't need any pain in the asses. So
would you rather train them from scratch?
I would. Mm-hmm. And I do different programs with the city. I've always been – I'm on the board of Schoolcraft College, and I host the culinary extravaganza every year. So I recruit chefs. And
which is coming up.
I'm the chair. Yeah,
September, right?
September 16th. Yep, Sunday, September 16th. And then also with the city, I've done some things with the workforce development projects, the reentry program for the jails, returning citizens. And we have some that work for us currently. And some different externship programs with the vocational schools. The city is really investing in Breithaupt right now, which was a vocational school that they're bringing back around. Uh-huh. They need $9 million. They already donated the first million, and they're engaging to try and get the other eight to get this up back to a full-service facility. And I'm working with Omar Hassan and some other people in the city to try and give some guidance in the curriculum and things like that. And we employ them, you know, for 120 hours at any given time, and then we evaluate them, and then hopefully they like their experience so much that they come back. But that's the innovative way to get your expansion. You know, we can't keep opening restaurants if we don't have the infrastructure, and the infrastructure is in things like that. Because somebody that comes to town or moves from somewhere else, say from Washington D.C., because they moved here for their gal or their family or whatever, they're going to She-Wolf and Chartreuse and Mabel Gray and Sheldon and me, and everybody's got to pitch them, and then somebody's going to get them.
Right, and then once you get them, then somebody else in the industry is going to poach them.
Yeah, is it so? Yeah. So there's just not a whole lot of people that are out there. So being on the board of Schoolcraft College, I have some cachet at the school and doing the event, and I meet lots of kids and give out lots of cards. And like I said, and then some of the development situations with the reentry program and the vocational schools. And they said we do it for a while. And you know, one gentleman we did, and then he was going to the Army, and he stayed an extra 3 months at the Peterborough.
Nice.
So he said, I'd love to stay working here. We thought he did a good job. We put him on full payroll and did that. And hopefully when he comes back, he'll consider working for us again. So there are ways that you can do that, but it is a tough market out there right now.
What do you think will give up first? Or what do you think will be the first problem? Will it be spaces to open restaurants, people to staff them, or people to visit them?
Well, I'm gonna go a whole different situation. And I will only mention Empire, and this is because of this. When I moved to Las Vegas in the early 90s, they were opening the Mirage, the Excalibur, the MGM Grand, and there was an article they wrote in the newspaper that said, you know, something's going to give. And the guy said, here's what I profess is going to happen. All the new places that are doing a good job and are interesting and different are all going to survive because people come downtown, or Las Vegas for that matter, and they want to go to those places. That's what they read about. And all the mom-and-pop places you've been going forever will always survive because you've been going there for 30 years. Your parents were there. A lot of tradition and food, and especially in Michigan, you know, about where you used to go when you were a kid. Mm-hmm. It's all the places in the middle that are just serving food, just serving beverage, or in case Las Vegas, just taking your money.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have any Cirque du Soleil show. They didn't have a celebrity chef restaurant. They didn't have anything. They didn't have a cool pool. You know what I mean? So there was no lure. And they all closed. You know, the Sahara, the Stardust, the Sands, the Dunes, the Frontier, you know, we did it all day long. So they're all gone. And I think at some point that's what's going to happen. There will be a bubble that will happen to where, and there's already restaurants that have closed. I mean, we're not going to talk about them because, you know, and a lot of times we don't because, like I said, back to the small town atmosphere, you know, people speak with their wallets. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to tell you where I'd eat or what I like or what I don't. I speak with my wallets. I just don't go or don't go back. You know what I mean? And people will start speaking with their wallets because not all of them are going to, there's not enough population density in the city of Detroit to have people come down or not enough people live down here to support every restaurant on a regular basis. So
sure.
There'll be just some places to just go by the wayside. As more open, someone's going to close probably for a little while.
It's interesting too because I know everyone asks chefs and cooks, hey, where would you like to eat? You know, or where do you like to eat when you're, and none of them have a chance to because they're always cooking, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the perverse part about the whole thing. They all want to benefit, you know, go to each other's places and stuff, but you know, when you have to take care of
I like places that are open on Sunday. We're closed.
You know, everyone has an industry night.
Exactly. Yeah. So. But yeah, I of course know a lot of the guys in the industry who try and eat at their places, you know, as much as possible, just from the camaraderie aspect, you know. And
absolutely.
It's a fun time. It's a fun time here in Detroit.
That's what I love about Detroit. I mean, there's competition, but there's not like nobody's. I mean, the people that I see that I love in the city, they're not stabbing each other in the back. They're supporting each other. They're at each other's events. They're okay if like, hey, you get a better gig over here, and blah blah blah. And there's, I mean, there's some people that are, you know, that are taking advantage of the system, but everyone else, there's that it's that team family kind of approach.
Yeah, and there's everybody has their own way of going about it. But like I said, and I don't single out anybody, but you know, if you talk to some people that I'm really close with, the Brian Perones, the Andy Holidays, the Dave Mancinis, you know, we're not social media guys. We're grinded out, getting your places, make them better type of things. You know what I mean? So a lot of the chefs that are very successful, the James Brigados, Doug Hewitts, they're like that too. You know what I mean? They're in their places. They're working really hard. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And they're trying to make their restaurants better every day. And that's why there is no competition, because they're not worried about what, just like me, not worried about what's outside. We're worried about what's inside. How do you get that better every day? Like you said, as opposed to worrying about what somebody's doing down the street or the new restaurant that opened across the street from me. I don't really care, because people will go for a little while and then they'll compare it. And hopefully the comparison says, we just rather go back there. Mm-hmm. So we all have work to do. You know, restaurants are like laundry. They're never finished.
Yeah, I mean, and if you operate your business as reactive like that, like you'll constantly be reacting to something. It's just not the way.
No, because you're focusing too much outward energy about like trying to compete when you're not looking at what's really wrong with your restaurant and why the hospitality isn't there, or where the food isn't better, or supervision is. I'm huge on the supervision aspect of the restaurant. So
in terms of that, like following that path, like negative reviews. And Jason, you could probably speak to this as well. You probably see them maybe more than Mark does. Like, how do you respond to negative reviews as a brand?
Or do you?
Right.
Well, we do with our general manager, especially if there's someone that really had a bad time. You know what I mean? There's different reviews that will say, well, it wasn't really what I liked, or I can't remember. There was one where she complained about, like, gave us some rating that wasn't so good because she couldn't find a place to park and things like that. You know, some things are out of your control. You know what I mean? I can't do much about that.
Right.
But usually when – although most of us don't like Yelp because we feel like most of them are not qualified to make the opinion, but they're also your customer base. They're the ones that pulled their wallet out and gave you the money. So you have to take that in consideration. You have to say that there was at least a portion of validity to what they had to say.
Mm-hmm.
The bartender didn't treat them right. They didn't get served in a proper manner. They waited too long for something. Are all things that will affect the review that you can correct.
Uh-huh.
So you have to at least take it seriously enough to say, like, I don't want to hear about how we didn't do this again. You know?
Unfortunately, every one of my non-foodie friends, anytime I'm out of the city, out of the state, they all go to Yelp. Every one of them. Yeah.
What do you mean?
When you're somewhere that you don't know where to go eat.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying.
But it can be used for research, because what I end up doing, I use it for keywords if there's certain things, and then you still have to read it with a grain of salt.
I'm talking about non-foodie friends. So I'm like someone who...
Well, but I'm saying there's a benefit to Yelp. You know, I mean, you don't have to completely crap on it.
Just like there's a benefit to Eater, there's a benefit to Google, there's a benefit to... You have to be a critical thinking human being.
But a non-critical thinking... I'm saying, like, you're
non-criticals go to Hungry Dudes.
Yeah. Wow.
So we were talking about Wolfgang Puck. I'll say one little note, that one thing that always stuck with me. So when one of the partners, Lee Hefter, used to come to town when I worked for Wolfgang, and he had a systematic way he did business. And what he would do is he'd come in on Friday, and regardless what time he came in, he wouldn't come in until service was open. So you didn't have a time to adjust. Like, you're already cooking, you're already set up or whatever. And he'd go through the walk-ins and he'd do all this stuff and look around. And then the next day at noon, he'd sit us all down and say, here's what's wrong with your restaurant. And he was like, blah, 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 blah. Now you fix those. I'll be back at 5 and we'll do it all over again. And so obviously you would, you know what I mean? You'd be foolish not to, back to the fastball down the middle concept.
Uh-huh.
So he'd come back and the service would be better. And so he would leave and he came back every 2 months. So you knew when he was coming back. So I would sit down with all the guys, and I say, here's the deal. Here's the 6 things that Lee didn't like about the restaurant. Make him find 6 new things.
Because
if he finds the same things, then we didn't respect his opinion.
Yep. Right.
So if you don't use Yelp for that capacity, you'd be foolish to say if the bartender takes too long or he was on his phone or he's screwing around. If you don't confront that and say, whether the perception was right, wrong, or indifferent, I don't want to get another review that says that happened again.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that's correct it like that. You know what I mean? Say, don't do that again. Make them find something else wrong with our restaurant next time they come, or we'll invite them back and hopefully the experience is better. But it is useful as a teaching tool. So he asked you the question, Jason. I'm sorry.
To
answer that for him.
I think he asked you. He just said I could speak on it.
Yes.
I mean, there, I, I take them all seriously. I think you can combine Yelp, Google, and Facebook reviews to create sort of an overall picture, average them out. One of the things I've started doing is tracking them over time and picking out like the key element of the review. You can chart those over time and then look at common threads that appear over time. So if people are saying repeatedly, the wait's too long, or, mm-hmm. you know, that'll show up over time. That's information that can be passed, you know, back to management. I mean, you know, looking at like whether people like Yelp or not, A, they're the customer, and strictly from like an analytical standpoint, you know, specifically at Writing Company, Yelp sends a fair amount of traffic to the Writing Company website. So people are using that as a discovery mechanism. So whatever you think about the people that are posting, other people are using that to discover information about your restaurant. And I'd venture to say probably, I mean, you look at that over time a lot more than one Free Press article or one Eater article, you know, those also add up over time. But, you know, those things are living, like we talked about before. Like, reviews are living. They're always on. They're always constantly being updated. So it's very organic. And, you know, if you work in marketing or in the shop, certainly in the kitchen, but and certainly in marketing, you'd be a fool not to look at that because people are giving you right. information that you can glean, you know, from. So, and I personally, I always start by saying thank you for your honest feedback, you know.
Right.
It's whether or not it is, you know, just try to empathize.
Sorry you didn't like our pies, but. You
know? Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Episode.
You obviously have no taste.
What was that? Episode 63?
Jill brings it up every episode. I'm just waiting for it now.
What?
Bring what up?
Your person that complained about your meat pies.
Oh, no. It's, no.
What? You know, it's funny you mentioned about the James Beard House. I was invited to cook at a guy named James House, and he did have a beard, but I didn't think it. In hindsight, it's not
was
this.
Is that a dad joke? Was that a dad joke? It was terrible.
It was the same guy.
I don't think it was. You know, it was in Highland Park.
Yeah.
Probably not the same
Did
guy.
He live in a van?
So I want to talk about like the process of opening a new place, right? And when that time is right. So you went from Writing Company, then you opened, was it Peterborough next?
Yep.
And then Bad Luck.
Yeah, we folded our money over several times. Now we're folding it back in the bank account for a minute, which is not, that's just a bad concept. I'm not going to lie to you. But, you know, the town has changed dramatically.
Right.
You know what I mean? As we talked about, we're very fortunate to be on the forefront. And, you know, just like everything with Bedrock, they need something to hang their head on. You know what I mean? To entice other people to come, just like the John Varvatos clothing store I felt. Did that for the retail program, you know what I mean? And now it's more competitive. We looked at lots of buildings. We've turned down lots of offers, you know what I mean? And not everybody understands how we feel that it should go, you know, investing in your own property, you know, tenant improvement plans, things of that nature. And also contractors have gone up substantially. I would venture to guess that it would cost us probably 50% more to open Writing Company today than it did 4 years ago.
Wow.
So, you know, so everything is just more expensive. So you have to pick and choose deals that are good. The Bad Luck was a really good deal for us. It was a really good deal for Broder Saxe too. I'm not going to lie to you. They're going to get all their money back in a nice period of time and make lots of money for free after that. So you know, people are looking at emerging markets now, New Center, you know, the West Village, you know, places like that. Mm-hmm. Even North End is getting some play now, especially mm-hmm. from the housing market. And it'll continue to go like that, you know, trying to find places, neighborhoods that will, you'll be there and get good deals. And, you know, there is a price to pay for that. We're not going to lie to you that Peterborough hasn't been as successful as we'd like it to. It's doing fine. You know what I mean? We're a little ahead of our time.
Jason.
You know what I mean? Yeah, no, but I'm saying so. You know, a lot of the things that we had speculated on and were told that were going to come around here took longer than they did. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily our fault, but you know, but like the founders and Diamond Jim Brady's, which is still empty
still
across
going.
You, you know,
yeah.
You know, and then this took a couple of years. The shipyard we're in right now. So if it was done on time, then we would have springboarded into do our position in a good spot. Earlier, you know, so you know, we're also a touch reluctant to be the first ones anywhere. You know, we have offers from opening places 7 Mile in Livernois. I said, as soon as you get somebody next to us, then I'll talk to you, but I'm not going to be the first one again. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, and I don't think we have to either, for just because we do some good stuff and we have successful businesses and we would like to be part of a bigger plan as opposed to like, we'll do it and then we'll go, oh, sooner or later, somebody will catch up around you. You know what I mean? That's not really in our psyche anymore either. I don't think it is in anybody's, you know what I mean? But
It's hard to be the only game in town.
Yeah, yeah. So especially in some emerging markets, you don't really know through the speculation how soon that will happen. You know, like I said, with Diamonds and Brady's, we've been open over 2 years at the Peterborough, and it was supposed to, you know, part of the program of building up this neighborhood. It's still vacant. So
did they open Ann Arbor? Wasn't there a second location? Or are they still with just Royal Oak?
They have a – and Royal Oak one is very new. I mean, yeah. After that bar rescue thing.
Reasonably newish. Yeah.
Well, yeah, right after that.
Yeah. No? I thought they had a date. Okay, so that's just – then we're just waiting on this then. Yeah. Okay.
So that's part of the game, shall we say. You know what I mean? So we're just trying to make sure the right deals.
With a W.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what are some of the different struggles that you have with someone, say, coming out of culinary school and someone coming out of the work release program? Like, what are the differences in training?
The thing I love about the work release program, and I don't mean to sound like a leader, they really want to work because they just got out of jail. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, seriously. I mean, they're like, thanks for the opportunity,
right.
Whatever you need.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because I need a job. I need an opportunity. And they're very eager to impress. You know what I mean? They're very eager to be part of something that they hopefully have upward mobility and things like that. So, cooking school, which, you know, has been sexy now in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, you know, they all think they deserve a job to run a restaurant. You know what I mean? Not all of them, but, you know, it's just tougher. You know what I mean? They expect more money. And I understand that, too. Cooking school is very expensive these days. You know what I mean? So they have to recoup, whether it's student loans, they have to start recouping their money, and I understand that. But they're more apt to, like, I need X amount. And I say, well, that's, you know, I have seasoned guys that make that much money. You want to come in at this amount and prove that you're as good as him, I'd be happy to give you that money. But I'm not just doing it just because. You know, they have very limited work experience. You know? The thing about school, and I went to school and I loved it, is it teaches you the basis of how to do everything right. But that don't mean that's the way I do it. That don't mean the way Andy does it. That don't mean that's the way Joel Robichon does it or Wolfgang Puck does it or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Everybody's got their style. You know what I mean? But you learn how to make everything right, how to make hollandaise right, how to make sauces right, the classic. You know? And that's the building blocks of your foundation. You know what I mean? But that don't mean if you didn't want to go to cooking school, you could learn that elsewhere as well. So it's not, I'm not promoting it one way or the other. But just because they went to cooking school doesn't mean that they can work at a high-volume restaurant, sauteing fish at a rapid rate, night after night after night after night. You know, they haven't experienced the grind. You know what I mean? And that's where it changes.
And does something like staging even help at that point? Like, is it? Like,
I think they have a little better idea about what they're going to get themselves into.
Okay.
You know, I had a guy that randomly just came in and said, I wanted to stage, and we were short staffed that night, and then he pretty much ended up being a helper on one of the stations, and I gave him some money on the way out because I felt bad. You know what I mean? Like, he just walked in and goes, I want to stop. I'm like, well, you can hang out if you want. And then he actually was in the grind for, you know, 6-8 hours. So I gave him some money on the way out. I felt bad. I'm like, you worked. You know, here's some money. And then I don't really have a full-time position for him. So I said, if you want to work part-time, or we'll keep you in mind or whatever. Because I wasn't looking for anybody when he came by. But he knows. If he walks in the writing company, because it was a Saturday night, he knows what he's getting himself into.
Wow.
So he's going to, if he decides that that's the career path he wants to go and we can pay him what he wants to do, he's like, I'm in, you know? So it's nice for them to see that, you know what I mean? To say that, to say they'll stand around on your phone, making a dish every once in a while type of restaurant. Like, we're moving, you know? There's a small plate concept lens to that because, you know, me and you go there and eat, we could order 6-7 plates. Well, every deuce does that. It's a lot of food going on.
Yeah.
A lot of plates. A lot of moving. You know, so.
So I'm curious. Now, this doesn't have to be an embarrassing story, but do you have any good Wolfgang Puck stories?
Wolfgang's
a totally different. Don't Google that. Please don't Google that.
I have lots of them, but my personal favorite is we did an event in Cleveland every year, and Wolfgang called me up, and it was Saturday night, and he goes, Mark, I'm going to come to Detroit on Sunday, but, you know, make sure the restaurant's busy. I don't want to come down and stand around all night. So I came up with this promotion that if you came to the Wolfgang Puck restaurant, I created a 3-course dinner for two, and if you came with a couple, it was $125, all-inclusive, and you got a cookbook signed by Wolfgang Puck at your table. So we packed the house. Wolfgang walked around, signed the cookbooks, drinking wine with everybody, you know. The night's over. We're sitting at the chef's table drinking some wine. And he goes, hey, Mark, what time we go on the airport tomorrow? You know, we'll go take a car. And I go, I'm not going to the airport tomorrow. He goes, why not? And I said, well, it's 160 miles. I'm going to drive. You know what I mean? I'll be there in 2.5 hours, leisurely, a couple of CDs, you know, and then you know, I'd be sitting in the airport for 2 hours. He goes, oh, okay. And so I went to go say goodbye. I go, I'm going to get up and say goodbye to the cooks. And I said goodbye to everybody. And I came back. He goes, we had another partner, Alex. He goes, me and Alex, we drive with you. And I'm like, well, that was really part of the program. He goes, we'll be at 10 o'clock. You come at 9:30, we eat some eggs and we go. And I'm like, what the hell? So at the time, this is the original restaurant, so it's probably been like 8 or 9 years now. I-75 was closed off until you got past the Ambassador Bridge. You had to go back down, you had to go to like Clark and get on. And then so all the trucks were coming off the Ambassador Bridge. There was only really one lane. And it's just pouring rain. So I can barely see all the water come off the trucks. And you know, I got Wolfgang Puck in the car. I'm not flying. So I'm going like 50 miles an hour, you know. And Wolfgang's just riding me. He's like, you're driving my car. I'm like, life, are we ever going to get to the potty or what? You know what I mean? So I'm like, Wolf, dude, I can't even see out the windshield. The windshield wipers can't go faster. He's like, oh, you know, you drive like this. You know. So we get going. He leaves me alone for like a half hour. Clearing up, he goes, now you got no more excuses. You know, like there's nobody in front of you. You're like, we're going to get there or what? You know, so we get to the Ohio Turnpike, and once again, he's giving me a hard time. He's like, you know, the party starts in 7 hours. Are we ever going to get there or whatever? So I'm like, Jesus. So I didn't know on the Ohio Turnpike that they catch you from the air.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm whipping behind this truck that's flying down the Ohio Turnpike, and I see a cop up in the distance. So I start to slow down, like, I'm not doing nothing wrong, you know? So the cop puts on his lights and he comes up behind me and he goes in front of me, pulls over the truck in front of me, you know? And then he slows down in front of me and I'm like, you too. You know, start like, get over. I was like, oh, Jesus. And Wolf's like, what's the problem? And I'm like, well, Wolf, we're going to get a speeding ticket. You know, so we roll down the window and the guy goes, sir, were you aware that you were speeding? And Wolf goes, I don't know why he was speeding. You know, I told him we had plenty of time to get to that event. And I'm like, listen, Wolf, it's not funny. It's not funny. You know what I mean? I'm done. He's like, no, seriously, he's driving like a madman. You know what I mean? You know, and so the guy starts laughing or whatever. And so he writes me, he goes, I'll be right back. He takes my license. I go, come on, Wolf. And so he writes me a ticket for like, it's $131. So they charge you every mile for over the speed limit or whatever. So we get to the event. And he goes to the guys, I'm sorry, we would have been here earlier, but, you know, Monk, he's a madman. He's driving crazy and he almost gets thrown in jail. He tells his uncle, he likes to do that. His sense of endearment was making fun of you. So he tells this 20-minute story about me almost getting thrown in jail, you know what I mean? And I'm like, well, if next time I drive with you, I'm just going to throw some cookbooks in the back. Maybe you can sign a couple and give me out of the ticket. You know what I mean? The next day, one of the partners called me up and said, hey, you know, I just want to tell you that Wolf had a really good time in Detroit when he did the party. He would tell you did a great job in Cleveland, and he wants to send you a check for the money for the ticket.
Aww.
And at the time, I wasn't really that well off, you know what I mean? And so I cashed it, but I should have kept the ticket and the check, you know, and framed it. That would have been my story on a mantle somewhere. But that was my best Wolfgang Puck story. So,
thank you,
Mark. Thanks for being with us tonight.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Best of luck.
Oh, thank you.
Until next time, dine well, friends.